College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
Welcome to the ESPN College Football Podcast with Herb Street and Pollock. Again, I'm your host, Kevin Negandhi. Herbie and Pollock will join me every week, three times a week, to discuss the best thing they saw over the weekend and get us ready for what should be a fantastic week ahead. We've got week zero in the books, and now the full slate of games coming your way in week one. We're going to talk a little bit about what Herbie saw in Orlando over the weekend between Florida and Miami, and then get you set overall big picture. The best teams in each single conference in the Power Five. We'll take a look at the Group Five, as well as Herbie's thoughts on the college football playoff, as well as maybe make a pick when it comes down to the Heisman, because I think everybody thinks it's going to be a battle between quarterbacks, but could we see a potential surprise at the end of the year in New York? Find out, because this will play out right in front of us. I feel like every single year we have an idea of something, and then it completely changes from August to September to October, and then bam, the surprise happens in November. No real surprise, Herbie, in the score that we saw in Orlando. We were expecting to see somewhat of a low-scoring game with Florida on top. I, though, watched this game, and I felt better if I was a Miami fan over feeling better as a Gator fan, even though you got the W.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, and I agree. I kind of left the stadium after calling the game, and probably had my initial reaction about, whoo, like you, man, Florida caught a break. You know, they, anytime you're minus three in the turnover margin and you get out of a game with a win, you count your blessings. And now I've had a couple days to kind of consume it. The one thing that I guess I remind myself, is that I've learned over the years, I'm very careful to judge a team based on that first game. You know, I think after we see them, that second week and third week, we're going to start to really be able to define where both those teams are, but especially Florida. I mean, the one thing about that first game, and Chris and I think talk about this throughout the broadcast, is it's college football. It's a ready, fire, aim situation. You know, in the NFL and even high school football, you and I talked about this last week on the podcast. You have preseason games. You have exhibition. You have a chance to kind of work out the kinks and learn some things. And what I see with college football is you have inter-squad scrimmages, but really until you get out in front of 70, 80, 90,000, 100,000 people on national TV, you have no idea how your team's going to respond, especially guys who are freshmen and guys that have never been put in that environment. So with that in mind, the most disappointing thing for me was all we talked about was how much Felipe Franks was going to flourish in his second year, right, in Dan Mullen's system. And the way he ended 18 with his four best games at the end of the year, and here he comes in after an entire offseason, he is really going to pick up where he left off. And he had some decent moments, but, man, he kind of looked like the same old Felipe Franks, where it was inconsistent, erratic, emotional. And I think that's what they had hoped he would kind of work to eliminate in the offseason. And again, it's one game. I'm not saying that's who he is in 2019, but if I were a Florida fan, especially Dan Mullen and the staff, I would love to see him go back and watch that film, and I would film him even how he acted on the sidelines at times and say, where can we get better? Yeah, it's some moments that were good, but Felipe, where can you get better as a quarterback and as a leader of this team, and kind of use those emotions that he plays with and try to kind of control those emotions and still play with that same fire. But I don't think he needs to be as demonstrative and is up and down with his emotions as he was last Saturday.
Herbie, I'm with you. The moment, like, he came out with a little bit of a swagger, and then the moment that fumble happened on the exchange with Pirine, it was like the Felipe Franks that we saw a couple years ago. It wasn't the one that closed out the season. He looked like he was trying too hard.
Yeah. And I thought, to be quite frank, I thought he had that look. And anybody who's super emotional, super competitive, gets, sometimes they're not necessarily using, you know, a wise approach. It's more emotional and erratic. And our cameras just happened to catch him when he came off after the fumble you're talking about. They're getting ready to go in and go up 14-3. And for all intents and purposes, all right, what are we going to talk about here? You know, this game's getting
shut
ready.
The door. Exactly.
Yeah. And then they fumble, and it was a miscommunication on a zone read, where for fans at home, a zone read is not just the quarterback reading a certain player. And based on what that player does, he either gives it to the back or he keeps it. And so typically it's just most plays in college and in the NFL, it's just a handoff. You just hand off. There's no read. But the zone read, so you understand, is the back and the quarterback have to see and feel the same thing. So when I put that ball into your stomach, even though when I initially put it in there, we don't know who's going to end up pulling away with it. But based on the read, it's kind of a soft pull. And the quarterback kind of eventually pulls it out, or he just kind of extends the ride, and the back just kind of soft squeezes it and goes away with it. So there's a little bit of doubt, or you're indecisive until mm-hmm. there's a certain moment. So if you watch that play really closely, Felipe's riding it, doing his job. The back's doing his job. And then there was a moment where at the end, Felipe said, okay, I want it. And the back said, we're past that point. I'm taking it. Felipe's taking it. The back's taking it. And finally, they both said, you take it at the same time. And the ball's on the ground, and Miami ends up catching a break. But the point is, his reaction to that on the sideline, his emotion, walking away from Dan Mullen as Dan Mullen's trying to teach him or coach him, it was almost like, I don't want to hear that right now. And that's the area where I think all of us hope that he's able to mature. And I love guys that play with fire. Don't get me wrong. I want the emotion. I want the fire. But when you're in that position, the quarterback, you're more of a CEO, and you've got to lead by example and play with that edge, but you can't be too emotional that it becomes detrimental to the team and what you're trying to accomplish. And I thought moments he was doing that.
Herbie, the one thing that also really surprised me, and we saw it was a bananas type game in the final 10 minutes, was the inconsistency of that season secondary with Marco Wilson. They made some plays where you're like, shut this down and let's go. Let's end the night. And they wanted to extend the night for the Canes offense. And I was stunned with the penalties out there on those final drives.
Yeah. Yeah. And first of all, I am a huge Todd Grantham fan. Like I love how he teaches his guys. I love how they play basically with their hair on fire. That's his style. I don't care where he's been over the years. That's what you're going to get. So they were taking advantage of the true freshman on one side, Nelson, the 60, who had a really rough night. Mm-hmm. He's on the left tackle. Campbell is a redshirt freshman at the right tackle spot. And Grenard was in that backfield. It seemed like ball snapped. He's in the backfield. And I thought that the secondary, as good as they are, and by the end of the year, we might be talking about Wilson and Cunningham being the best tandem of corners, not just in the SEC, but maybe in the country.
I'm with you.
So, you know what I'm saying? So they're very talented. But, yeah, not using your mind, not knowing down and distance, not knowing it's fourth down, you know, just tackle the guy and the game's over, just making mental errors. And that's part of week zero. We get it. But the one thing that frustrated me the most was when DJ Dallas ran on a touchdown run, the unwillingness to tackle. You know, it's one thing to just, the guy's a great runner and he ran through some. This is just like Ole, just kind of throwing their body with no arms, and that's disappointing. So the good thing is about this, they all get to go back to the film room. The coaches get to go, hey, you're a great player, but look at this. And mm-hmm. look at this, and yep. look at this, and look at this. You're better than that. Let's go to work. Let's go out to practice today with intensity and with purpose, and let's improve. We've got to get better than that. And hopefully they're able to watch that film and realize, wow, what coach has been saying all along in practice, I got to buy in, because I thought I'm great, and I am. But I can be a lot better and a lot more consistent, a lot smarter with how I play the game.
Yeah, the D-line really saved them at the end of the game, and now they've got 2 weeks to watch that film and go through all the missed tackles that we saw in that secondary as they get ready for UT Martin. And then it's Kentucky, and of course that contest from a year ago. Now they go to Kentucky, and then they come back with Tennessee. So, you know, you've got enough tape there. Like you mentioned, early on, you work out the kinks. It's not a preseason game, and now you got to face a rival. Now you got to figure it out the next 2 weeks before getting your feet underneath you with UT Martin. On the other side, though, I thought Jaren Williams did a phenomenal job dealing with the pressure and having that youth at tackle on both sides, and he almost pulled it out. Granted, he held on to the ball a little too long late in that game, but he's trying to make a play. And the one thing that really stood out, no interceptions when he was feeling the heat all night long.
100%. And you could probably tell if I don't know if you were able to hear any of the broadcast, but I was just so impressed for a guy that's making his first start as a redshirt freshman with the environment. It's a big rivalry within that state. A lot of these guys know each other. The intensity's kind of up at almost a different level because it's the first game of the year, and he's got an offensive line that's trying their best, but they're not having a lot of success. And most often, that would be the recipe for a young freshman to panic, to get out a little bit early, to throw the ball away, to scramble right away. And he had moments where he did that, but for the most part, when he had time, man, he trusted the pocket. He stepped into the pocket, kind of climbed into the pocket, which takes a lot of courage considering that defensive line, the way they were getting after him. He was delivering the ball when he had moments, you know, with accuracy. He was poised throughout the game. Now, he's obviously going to grow immensely. But if I'm a Hurricane fan, yeah, I'm sad that they lost. But I'm really anxious to see him grow in week two and week three and week four. And I walked out of there thinking, if you look at their schedule, you probably have it right in front of you. Why not dare to dream? Why not just like Florida, go back to the drawing board, learn where can we get better, especially with Dan Enos and that offensive line and pass pro, and let's move that launching point, help him out the best we can with a better running game, help the pass protection with a better running game. Look at that schedule. I mean, it's very manageable, and it's not, to me, I think they end up in Charlotte. I think if they can keep growing, Miami should be a team, if they can avoid, you know, big injuries, that should get to the ACC championship game against Clemson and win 9 games, maybe, yeah, 10 games.
The Coastal is winnable, and you mentioned the schedule. They get another week off as well, like Florida, and then they go to North Carolina, and we know we have a soft spot for Mac Brown, but Mac's team, he's inheriting a team that's super young. I think they're a couple years away, so when you look at this jumping-off point for Manny Diaz, after North Carolina, Bethune-Cookman, Central Michigan, and then in October, it's Virginia Tech. But the thing is, you have Virginia Tech at home. You have UVA the following week at home.
Right.
Georgia Tech at home. That's a nice run there for a young group.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the rest of their schedule, you could make a case that going to Tallahassee in a rivalry game is always a tough thing. But other than that, there's a very good chance they could be favored in most of the games that they play. Now, with all that being said, the one thing I would say, this is college football, and I'd put a little asterisk next to it, is just as easy as you can make a case that this team could get on a pretty good run, they're not there yet emotionally, maturity-wise. They're still a team that 1 week could, you know, find a way to beat Florida, and the next week they could lose to Central Michigan. You know, so that's what they're going to have to guard against, is starting to try to get ahead of themselves. Manny, in his first year as a head coach, think about the team that he inherited. I mean, they were a team that was a disaster the second half of the season. And a lot of these guys were on the field for those games. And there was, to me, a divide between the defense, which was playing championship caliber ball, and the offense, which was struggling mightily. And he's trying to bridge all that together. He's got a new strength coach. So there has to be a buy-in. There has to be a maturity. And as they start to win games, if they win one and they win two and they win three, people are going to start to pat them on the back. And that's new for them. They have to just try to kind of stay laser focused 1 week at a time. And if they can do that, there's no reason this team should not have a chance to win up to 10 games.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's a fine line, too, with this team. They could potentially be a 2-loss team or a 6-loss team. It's how they handle adversity throughout the season here. You mentioned the ACC and the Coastal. The Coastal is one of those divisions, of course, everybody's going to bring up in a comparison, like the Big Ten West, like trying to figure out who is going to be good enough enough for the other side, and of course that's the dominance of Clemson. Is there anybody else, when you look at the Coastal, is there anybody else in the rest of the conference that could even get close in the conversation with a team like Clemson, what they're doing right now?
Man, I think it's hard to imagine that. You know, I if you break down, you know, each of the divisions, Clemson's clearly the team, but you know, until we see Florida State get up there, until you see them consistently become the team athletically that you know they're capable of being, it's really hard to imagine anybody outside of Clemson, Miami, Florida State. I feel like Virginia Tech is still a team with Justin Fuente still kind of rebuilding. How many players left that team a year ago? And he brought in a few more, but it's almost like they've hit a reset button, even though Justin Fuente's been there for a few years, just because of all that, that went on. Virginia has a chance. I mean, I think Bronco Mendenhall's done a really good job with the defense, and they've got one of the best dual threat quarterbacks this year in Bryce Perkins. So I think there's some people that feel that Virginia could kind of be a wild card and a team to look out for. But outside of that, man, it's clearly Clemson. And then everybody else, and then who's going to become that team that's kind of sneaking around? They get the 6, 7, or 8 wins, like an NC State has done in the past, like a UVA did last year. But to me, I still think the two teams that in each division or teams to beat would be Clemson on one and Miami on the other, just because the overall skill and athletic ability and the quality of their young quarterback.
How do you view Syracuse?
I like them. I'm going to really wait to find out who they are based on how they play, not against Clemson, but against Maryland the week before. You know, I think there's going to be so much anticipation for what they could do potentially. What is it? The last two times they beat Clemson once at home at the Carrier Dome. Should have beaten them last year, you know, until Clemson found a way to win that game with their backup quarterback. So I think they believe, and there's going to be a lot of, wow, can you believe Syracuse? Look at this. This is a big game at home again against Clemson. And they're going to have to, Dino Babers going to have to get them to get ready for Mike Locksley and the Terps, because Mike Locksley's looking right now at his season thinking, this would be a great opportunity to have kind of that win that shows people this is a different Maryland team. And what better way than to beat a ranked Syracuse team to try to create some attention and momentum for his program. So I'm excited. If you look at him on paper, there's a lot to like there. You know, if the young, they have a young quarterback also they're breaking in. If he can come through, there's a ton to like there. I love Dino Babers' system. They're going to score a lot of points. But it's another team. Can they show the maturity of not thinking about Clemson? All our focus is on Maryland. That's when you're really going to find out what kind of team I think they have this year.
Florida State's intriguing too. You brought them up a little bit with Willie Taggart. He just named the redshirt sophomore James Blackman his starting quarterback here. They get ready for a game against Boise in Jacksonville. I'm interested to hear your thoughts about bringing in Kendall Briles, the shakeup there and changing that offensive philosophy.
Well, he has a proven track record of being able to call plays and put an offense together that's very challenging to stop. I thought it would, to be honest, I kind of scratched my head initially. I thought, you know, it was a year where a lot of head coaches at big programs were looking for coordinators. You know, you think about the different names that surfaced, and it became a little bit, when I think back to that moment in December and January of last year, a little bit of a moment of, who can I get to first? You know, who can make that the right hire? And Florida State was one of the more, of all the schools, probably the school that was the biggest in need of being able to make that good hire. And Willie Taggart, known historically kind of more of a Jim Harbaugh guy with his offense. And then he had success at South Florida. He took that same offense and same philosophy, more of a spread attack out to Oregon. And then he comes down to Florida State. Doesn't really have the consistency at quarterback. So he felt he had to go out and just kind of shake it up. And again, another guy that wanted to kind of think outside of the box. And he's done that. Briles, you know, if you look at UCF, you see that offense there. If you look at Missouri, you see that offense there. You know, you see it all over the country. There's different places that try to run their version of a spread. And I always just think, of course, obvious, you go back to the Baylor offenses that were really humming when they would put those receivers almost all the way to the sideline and they would force the defense. Are you going to take your defensive backs all the way to the sideline and let us play on the inside and run the ball? are you going to be more concerned about our ability to run? And now you're going to leave one-on-one opportunities on the outside. That's who Florida State's going to be. I found it interesting that James Blackman announced now over Alex Hornibrook, the veteran from Wisconsin who was a grad transfer. We'll see how he does. And we'll see if Hornibrook gets in there and gets much of a chance at all to throw the ball. But this is – if I'm a Florida State fan, I'm excited about the potential of this offense. There's never a shortage of playmakers. To me, it's more about can James Blackman, or if he can't, can Alex Hornibrook – be a quarterback that's in sync with Ken, with Briles and what he does as a play caller. If they find that, they'll be a tough offense to slow down.
And Blackman started 13 games over the last 2 years. My only fear for Blackman and watching him too is can they protect? Florida State has gone through some horrendous line combinations the last 2 years. And you mentioned, it's a segue here with Willie Taggart changing his offensive philosophy. Let's go to the Big Ten and Jim Harbaugh. And Taggart and Harbaugh have that connection at Western Kentucky, and Harbaugh's dad coached Willie Taggart. So they come from the same source here. And then Jim trying something different with Michigan and going with Gattis as his offensive coordinator and changing this philosophy that we got used to seeing at Stanford. Hey, we're going to line up our guys. We're going to go two tight ends. We may load up the backfield. We're going to just punch you in the face. No, we're going to spread things out a little bit after, you know, honestly, catching some humble pie against Ohio State the last few years, as well as against teams like Michigan State and not beating teams in the top 10. What are your thoughts on the pressure, this idea with Michigan in trying now that Urban is gone, trying to get back into the conversation that, hey, they deserve to be in the Big Ten championship, something we have not seen under Harbaugh.
Kevin, I'm so excited to see the Big Ten East this year, not just Michigan and Ohio State, but quietly, Michigan State ranked up in the top 20 before the season starts. Penn State's up in the top 15 before the season starts. You're talking about having four teams in one division in the top 20 in the country. And to me, I think by the, you know, week two, week three, week four and on, I think those numbers could go up. So before I get to Michigan, I think people have to be, when Mark D'Antonio, who doesn't throw around a lot of compliments, comes out of camp and says, feel really good about our camp, feel really good about how the players are caring for each other, working for each other. That scares me. If you're against Michigan State, because that means the intangibles of that team are coming together. To me, it's about Brian Lewerke and the offense being better and being more balanced. And they've made some changes on their staff as well, just like Michigan has. And we'll see if that pays off for them. Penn State, I almost feel like they're a completely forgotten team as we approach 2019. Just forgotten about. And I don't know if it's because, you know, they lost Trace McSorley and before that Saquon Barkley. I don't know if it's just people just don't expect much. I do. As long as James Franklin's there recruiting the way he is, I think they have a chance to be a dominant team this year and very, very good. Now, with all that being said, leads me to Michigan. I found it somewhat entertaining the way Josh Gattis left Alabama. Dan Enos left Alabama. Dan Enos, who went to Miami. Josh Gattis, who left Alabama to go to Michigan. Boxley, who, by the way, was the offensive coordinator, despite what you read and hear about with some of the other coaches. Mike Loxley is now the head coach at Maryland. And when you read about it, you would think that Josh Gattis was calling the plays and managing Tua and Jalen Hurts. And he's never called plays. And so he's got a huge stage and a huge opportunity. And I would tell you, regardless if he stayed at Alabama or he ended up going to Michigan, if you ask me, name five offensive coaches who are kind of the young guys, up and coming, shooting stars in the business, I would have told you a year ago, Josh Gattis is among them. Like, he is a rising star. So I'm not surprised at all that Jim Harbaugh made that selection. Think about where he's been with Penn State. Mm-hmm. He's been around that Joe Moorhead offense where it's a kind of a dual threat quarterback running and throwing, and Saquon Barkley was a big part of that. And then he goes down to Alabama and he's has a chance to be around the minds of Mike Loxley and Dan Enos and Tua and Jalen and all the weapons that Bama had. So he's consuming all of this information, and James Franklin from the days that he was with him at Vandy in Penn State. So he brings all of that now to Ann Arbor with Shea Patterson, who, by the way, is a perfect fit for that kind of offense. They've got great receivers. They got to find a few backs, but they've got great receivers. All of it makes sense to me. I just think that Michigan and Jim Harbaugh, the days of just huddling up, lining up, running that power play to the left and power play to the right, occasionally getting into some spread looks like they did last year with Shea Patterson. I think that for Jim Harbaugh to say, I got to change, I got to mix in more tempo, it just goes to show you where we are with offensive football in the college game in 2019, because he's really one of the last guys to hold on to, you know, 12 personnel, two tight ends, run the ball, use the fullback. And I'm sure there'll still be elements of that, but now I think he's seeing the advantage and the frustrations he's had with trying to beat Ohio State when that's what he's been, Don Brown's been trying to defend is that style of offense. So I'm excited. I can't wait. I think Shea fits perfectly. And even McCaffrey with his skill set fits perfectly with what they're going to try to do. And, I wish Josh Gattis the best of luck, you know, for being a first time play caller, and hopefully it works out. If they're in a game and it doesn't
work
out.
That's what I want to know.
You know, being known as a play caller, I mean, is he going to just sit there and go, good job, Josh. Keep hanging in there, Josh. You'll get this thing going. What's he going to do?
What's going to happen against Wisconsin when you're on the road September 21st and things are not moving along the way he wants to? That's what I want to know. How are they going to respond with some adversity? I mean, they open up against Middle Tennessee and then Army, and that's going to be a huge physical game. But then where the adversity sets in, how's Harbaugh going to handle that, and where's his patience going to be with that team? Now, let's go to the other side, that division. And much has been made about the battle in the East, but the West feels like it's wide open. And you have your usual suspects in the idea of Wisconsin and Iowa and, of course, Northwestern. What do you think of Nebraska and Scott Frost? Are they ready to make the leap?
I liked Nebraska last year when they were sitting there. What did they start? 0-6 or 1-5 or whatever it was.
It was brutal, yes.
I remember making a comment that I'm seeing enough, even though they're not winning games and they're not into moral victories in Lincoln, but I was seeing enough from Adrian Martinez and the team, and I thought the way Scott Frost led them through that adversity, just his facial expressions and his comments after games, I was like, man, they are so close last year. I remember making a comment, they're going to win their last six. They're going to end up 6-6. They're going to go to a bowl. And you go back and look at the way they finished. Man, they had some opportunities to win those last six. So I think despite a very bad record a year ago, internally, I think there's a ton of belief in kind of the direction they're going. They got a great quarterback who's only going to get better. He's got some skill around him. Spielman, J.D. Spielman's one of the better receivers in the Big Ten. He'll have a monster year this year. I just don't know if they're there defensively for the week in, week out grind that it takes to be able to avoid, you know, a hiccup or two. I still think that Wisconsin, another team that I feel is somewhat forgotten, because of the way their season went last year. This Big Ten West, by the way, used to just be, you know, Wisconsin and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And man, these last couple years, think about the hires that this division has made. You know, with PJ Fleck now at Minnesota, and they're starting to show some life. We just talked about Scott Frost, Pat Fitzgerald. He's been there forever. He does an amazing job with that brand. Jeff Brohm now in West Lafayette and Purdue. Of course, Paul Christ at Wisconsin and Lovie Smith trying to get better in Champaign. But top to bottom, That is a lot of young energy and great recruiting and fundamentals and doing it the right way. And it's very, very hard to sit here before we see any of them play and say definitively, this is the team to beat. It's definitely Nebraska. It's definitely Wisconsin, because there's so much depth in that division. Really, it's going to come down to who gets the best quarterback play and who avoids the injuries. That'll be the team that ends up winning it. And I'm just basically guessing that I think Wisconsin's going to be the team with Jonathan Taylor and their new young quarterback, Jack Cohn. I think they have the combination, and they're due for a new wave of defensive players. You know, there for a while, they had a lot of guys around for a long time. Now it's time for that next wave of guys. Reminds me of the year they opened with LSU at Lambeau, when nobody really expected anything from them. In fact, they went into that game against LSU like, oh my gosh, they're going to get killed.
Yep.
And they played with kind of that chip on their shoulder. I think Wisconsin's going to be back to that in 2019, and that's really the main reason I give them the edge over everybody else.
And to your point with Nebraska, they did open up the season, six straight losses, and then, let's not forget, in November, almost beat Ohio State on the road, almost beat Iowa on the road at the end of the season. So,
sure did.
It provided a ton of hope. It looked like that second half of the season, you know, the light bulbs went on and understanding what Frost wanted. Now, let's go to the Big 12 here. And obviously, Oklahoma's dominance has been there, and there's not going to be a Texas is back joke here on this podcast, but when you look at the gap here with Oklahoma losing that offensive line that feels like everybody went to play on Sundays in the NFL, they were so dominant, and then you bring in Jalen Hurts and the magic of Lincoln Riley, but when you look at Texas, to me, the health of Ellinger is the difference in this entire conference, but they also are a little beat up there when you look at depth on their defensive front. How do you view this gap between Oklahoma and Texas and then the rest of the Big 12?
I still think that there's a pretty good gap there. You know, I think it is Oklahoma and Texas, and then we try to get cute and we say, I'm going to be different. You know, I think Matt Campbell, with Brock Purdy, I think Iowa State is a team, that's going to win the Big 12. And by the way, if they don't win nine or eight or nine, I'd be shocked. So I think Iowa State is the kind of the new Kansas State in the Big 12.
I like that. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, and with a young coach and with the way they play, they remind me of Kansas State from years ago. And then there's Matt Rhule and Baylor. And man, just when you think you've forgotten about Baylor, Matt Rhule's gone down there and done it the old-fashioned way. He's earning it each step that he has made, and he's trying to bring some pride back to that brand. And I really like kind of the direction that they're heading. So those are the teams when I look at this conference top to bottom. I think it's Texas and OU, and then I think look out for Iowa State. Look out for Baylor. I still think Oklahoma State, just out of respect for Mike Gundy, and I think he's got maybe one of the better playmakers in the conference, and Tylon Wallace, who I think is one of the top receivers in the entire country, possibly. So he's got playmakers in the backfield, with Hubbard now stepping in outside of Justice Hill, who's graduated. And it's just a matter of finding a quarterback. But I love Mike Gundy's system. Love how he comes up with ways to attack defenses. So they would be my wild card there. But I'm going with Texas this year to win that conference.
Ooh.
Yeah, I think that Tom Herman has recruited now well enough that as we sit here right now in August, we're not going to know a lot of the names right now. But after the LSU game and what is it, week two, I think all of us are going to start to say, how about this guy, and how about this guy, and how about this guy? I think now we're going to start to see more depth and more skill. And, you know, Colin Johnson's an obvious guy, but they've recruited at a very, very high level. And I got a lot of confidence in Tom Herman as a coach. And Sam Ellinger, to me, is kind of the modern day of Tim Tebow as far as what he means to his team. How he, when he runs the ball, how he runs with physicality and runs over safeties, runs over linebackers, especially in the red zone. And a team, they tend to feed off of a quarterback that plays kind of in that fashion with that kind of energy and tenaciousness. So I would give Texas just a slight edge over Lincoln Riley and OU, and me still kind of being 1 foot in, 1 foot out on Jalen Hurts and if he can be that guy every single week that I think all the Oklahoma fans hope he can be.
Keep an eye. Of course, you mentioned it. That second game of the season, that to me is one of the biggest games in all of college football. That is, of course, taking on LSU. That's a 7:30 game on ABC, September 7th. Looking forward to that on the call. And then, when you look at the start of October, they got to go to Morgantown to face West Virginia and Austin Kendall. And then you got the big showdown at the Cotton Bowl against Oklahoma. So those are the two games to circle. And, of course, keeping Ellinger healthy. I love that you mentioned Matt Rhule being a Temple guy. What I love is that he has brought that meat and potato attitude into the Big 12 by saying, you guys have all this flashy offense everywhere, but we're going to play defense. We're going to hit you in the face. And it's okay that we're going to hit you in the face. We've got some playmakers on the outside, but also you're going to have to run through us if you want to win this game when you come to Waco. I love that about Baylor.
What's great about that is there was a time when the spread or a version of the spread was the wild card, you know, for defensive coaches. It's like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do this week? We got to go up against the spread and we're going to play with five DBs this week, and we got 6 days to get ready for this different wrinkle of an offense. And as you know, now it's the opposite. Now that's all teams have. Teams base defense is a 4-2-5 or a 3-3-5. They're looking to get more speed on the field, smaller players that are quicker that play in space. Now all of a sudden here comes Baylor, and of course they'll spread you out. But as you said, there's a toughness there that they pride themselves on that's very, very different from most of the offensive styles that you go up against week in and week out.
Looking forward to it. Cannot wait to see what Baylor brings, especially the turnaround that we've seen in Rule in the past 2 years to go to a bowl game. It's outstanding where that program was and where he picked it up. Let's go to the Pac-12 here. And what I find fascinating when you look at the Pac-12, it feels like there are three teams in the top 15 where they could be all interchangeable. That's Oregon, that's Utah, and that's Washington. It's stunning that we haven't even brought up teams that we used to in the past, like Stanford and USC. How do you view this conference?
Man, this is another one where, you know, you kind of want to guess. Utah seems to be the trend. They seem to be the team that everybody's talking about. And when Kyle Whittingham says this is maybe the best defensive line I've had since I've been the head coach at Utah, that I think anybody who watches Pac-12 football kind of raises their eyebrows. I mean, that's a powerful statement and a reason for Utah fans to get excited. So I'm not poo-pooing Utah at all, Kevin. I just don't know if they have the offensive firepower to be able to just win with defense. Zach Moss, a good back. Huntley can run around and make some throws. But, you know, in that conference, you even though their defense is good, I still think you got to be able to score points and a lot of points. And I don't know if they're going to have that ability to do that. I think their margin of error is much smaller than these other teams. Now, with that being said, if it's not Utah, who else is it? I keep every year I say USC, 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 because I can't help looking at that roster. And how do you not say USC?
I'm with you. I understand.
I think there's nobody's a bigger fan of Clay Helton than me. I mean, I love the guy as a person and hope it works out there. I'd love to see him shut everybody's mouths up, especially his own fans, if he could have a big year. But with that being said, I'm going Arizona State and Herm Edwards.
Herm!
How about it? He may have the best back in the conference in Eno Benjamin. He's got good receivers back. He's got a young quarterback that we'll see how he plays. I like their defense. So, it's another division where you're kind of throwing a dart. I think USC is the most talented, but I'm going to go with ASU over Utah and USC. And then up north, I really like Oregon. I mean, I'm excited. I'm going to call their game. Game day will be down there Saturday for the Oregon-Auburn game. And boy, what an opportunity for Oregon and for really the whole Pac-12 as Mario Cristobal and the Ducks come all the way back to the east, at least to Dallas, to be able to play this game. So Justin Herbert, huge fan of his. And I think in his second year, these guys are going to be playing at a faster pace. I think their schedule's pretty demanding. And with that being said, I'm going to give Chris Peterson the nod and kind of a back and forth battle between those two. And I'm a huge Pac-12 fan. I love the conference and one of these guys that stays up late. In fact, I was up this past Saturday, you know, called the game in Orlando, got back to the TV just in time for about the middle of the fourth quarter.
Arizona.
To see Hawaii and Arizona and watching that game go back and forth. Came down to the last play of the game.
As expected, right?
Yeah. Hey, exactly. But I love those 2 a.m. Pac-12 games. I'm probably speaking for myself.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
But anyway, I'm going to go, as I said, go with Washington and Oregon battling it out and give the Huskies just a little bit of an advantage there.
And what will be the difference in your mind? Does that come with the quarterback play here? I mean, we see, of course, Eason there, the transfer from Georgia. He's coming back to the area. He just won the job. Is that Eason's arm? Is that Eason's ability in that offense?
Schedule for me.
Schedule.
Getting Oregon in a rivalry game at home is huge. Middle of October, they get Utah at home, which is also big. The Apple Cup, which always seems to be, even if you're favored heavily, it's a rivalry game. That one's at home. So for me, that's the probably the biggest reason that I would give them the advantage over Oregon. I talked about Oregon's schedule. They have some games at home, but, you know, they have to go to Stanford. They have to go to Seattle. Got to go to the L.A. Coliseum to take on USC. They got to go to Arizona State late in the year, which will probably be a night game. So I think more than anything, it has probably as much to do with scheduling. If you're just looking at quarterbacks, I think you'd have to go with Justin Herbert over Jacob Eason. Jacob Eason, to me, is one of the biggest mysteries of the 2019 season. Yep. Five-star, number one ranked guy. The whole world wanted him, what, about 3 years ago coming out of high school. He goes to Georgia. He's the guy as Georgia's trying to win some games. Doesn't have a great freshman year and, of course, comes back the next year, gets a little bit dinged up in a game, and here comes Wally Pipp, Jake Fromm, and the rest is history with Jake Fromm. And Jacob Eason leaves, for all intents and purposes, really hasn't played a lot of football for a couple years, and now we'll see if he's ready to go.
All right, now let's talk a little bit about that Oregon-Auburn matchup, and then we'll eventually segue to the SEC here. What's at stake here? When you look at it, it is early in the season, and the narrative has not been set, but what's at stake here for a team like Auburn coming in, where Oregon could come over, beat them, nothing, I don't think anybody blinks, but if Auburn pulls off the upset with Nix there at quarterback and the pressure on Gus?
Man, I look at it like Oregon, I don't want to say they have pressure on them, but I think the conference has pressure on them.
The Pac-12.
Yes. Cause I feel like when I travel, I love to talk to college football fans and, you know, they love to give their opinions and let you know what they think. And I really think when you get east of the Rockies, people have very little respect for the Pac-12. And every time the Pac-12 gets on a big stage, not every time, but that's the stereotype, they seem to not do very well. And the cynics just kind of mock them, and they kind of look down their nose at them. And, you know, there's your big, because I'm always preaching Pac-12. And then when they lose, they like to remind me how the Pac-12 performs against a team like Auburn, or when Oregon played LSU, or when they played Ohio State in the Rose Bowl, or whatever it might be. And to me, I think that Oregon is representing an entire region. And I don't know if they as players feel that or if the coaches do. Mario Cristobal has an interesting perspective with his coaching background, especially being in Alabama and then going over there to become an assistant and eventual head coach. I think he knows what I'm talking about that stereotype, and nothing would probably make him happier than to be able to come all the way to Dallas and take on Auburn and beat them. So I feel like even though Auburn is starting a young quarterback in Bo Nix, I think because of the conference, and when was the last time the Pac-12 had a team in the playoff? You know, I mean, it's been
awful. Yeah. And when they're there, they've been embarrassed, like we saw with Washington a few years ago against Bama.
Exactly. And I think Oregon, you know, they were able to beat Florida State and lose to Ohio State in the national title in the first year in 14. So I think they're fighting a perception problem. And I think Larry Scott, probably as a conference commissioner, probably has as much at stake as anybody this weekend in that game, even though he's not going to throw one pass or make one tackle, because I'm just being honest, they need a win. And even Washington, they competed with Auburn last year, but they lost a game. And it's almost like you don't get credit for that. You don't get credit for hanging around.
Yes.
They need to win the game.
Yep.
So I think there's pressure on that conference to do well Saturday. But man, Auburn has set their sights, like they do every year, very high. I can't wait to see Bo Nix. I've seen him play in high school. Obviously know about Patrick, his father, who was a great player at Auburn, became a great college coach and now high school coach who he played for. So there's a lot there to watch to see how that unfolds. Auburn has had some injuries at wide receiver. It seems like a few of those guys, Will Hastings and Eli Stove, look like they're going to be back after missing all of last year. So that's good news. The matchup of the entire weekend will be Oregon's offensive line, which a lot of people feel is the best in the country. They're all back from a year ago. And you have Auburn's defensive line that a lot of people feel that they could be the best in the country. So watching them go head-to-head, and they have Justin Herbert, who, again, in a year where you have Tua and Trevor Lawrence and Jake Fromm and Sam Ellinger and all these big names, don't forget about Justin Herbert and what he can bring at 6'6", about 245 pounds, can throw it, can run it. So, man, that when Auburn's defense goes against Oregon's offense, that's going to be a fun matchup to watch.
I'm with you. I think actually Auburn has the best defensive front in all of football. And you mentioned the seasoned quarterbacks, but there is a trend too where we've seen some seasoned quarterbacks decide to come back and then some coaches make decisions that I want to go with a true freshman. And Gus going with Bo Nix, you want to feel really old here. The young man was 10 years old when Cam Newton won the national championship.
Wow.
That gives you some perspective. He was at the game. There's a picture of him in Sports Illustrated wearing a Cam Newton jersey. And what do you think of Gus deciding, hey, I'm going to put my entire offense with this young man, this belief that he's going to spark this offense. We're going to generate some offense and open up the season with a ton of expectations. And sometimes a little bit unreasonable when we're talking about Auburn.
Oh man, I just hearing that story,
it's crazy, right?
It is. I mean, Cam Newton seems like he was there just a few years
exactly.
ago. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's remarkable. I think that Gus Malzahn has probably changed for the better, and I'm not saying he was a dog before. I'm just saying that his personality has changed a lot in the last few years, and I don't know if he feels that he's got the backing of the community and the school, but he is, his spirit feels different. And I know he's going back to calling plays this year, and I've heard his players talk about, man, he just feels different. He sounds different in meetings. It's like he's rejuvenated his career and almost has a different approach. So for him to go and say, I'm calling plays, I haven't done it in 3 years, I'm excited to get this thing going. And you know what? I'm going with that guy right there, that true freshman. He's going to be my guy. I'm just because of all that, the way Gus has been going, I'm not necessarily surprised. And I think at the end of the day, it wasn't about true freshman or redshirt freshman. I think it was about who's better, who looks better, who has better command throughout the scrimmages in August, who knows the offense, who can throw it and run it. See, Bo Nix can throw it. But Bo Nix can really run. Mm-hmm. You know, he's more of what they need. To me, when Auburn is Auburn, and Gus likes to say, my offense works whether it's a thrower or a runner. I would argue, since he's been at Auburn, when Cam Newton's running that offense, it's scary.
Yes.
When Nick Marshall's running that offense, it's scary. When a quarterback that likes to throw it, Stidham type of guy is running it, it's good, but I don't know if it's scary. And so, I know that they want to go back to being a dual threat, you better respect the quarterback running kind of offense, and I think that's what we'll see beginning this weekend with Gus calling the plays and with Bo Nix in a quarterback.
Cannot wait. The way this, obviously everybody's going Alabama, Alabama, Alabama. The way the SEC and the way it looks, especially with the idea of LSU in week two against Texas. I think the gap with A&M's a team that could potentially surprise a ton of people and could be the talk of the middle of the season if they have a run. Their schedule is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then the gap here where has Georgia closed it with Alabama. How do you view this conference with the teams I just mentioned?
How about A&M at Clemson? If it's not hard enough playing in the SEC West, just for fun, they're going to go play at Death Valley week two. And take on Trevor Lawrence and Clemson, who they gave all they could handle a year ago when they had him at Kyle Field. But it's a home and home, so they go to Clemson. They've got Auburn at home. You know, they've got Alabama, but at home.
At Georgia. At LSU, back-to-back weeks.
Back-to-back. And if they somehow survive all that, they get to go to Atlanta and try to go play in the SEC championship, which I think with that schedule is going to be very, very hard to do. But with that said, Jimbo Fisher's second year, Kellen Mond is going to be as good as a quarterback as they'll have, I think, as A&M has had in a long time. I think he's going to do a good job of spinning it and making good decisions and putting up some big numbers. Most of his receivers, if not all of them, except the tight end, are back this year. So they're going to score a lot. They got a great defensive coordinator. I just don't think with that gauntlet, that they get beyond, if they get to 9-3, that would be a ridiculous year in his second year, considering the schedule.
That's
and
a top
who,
10 team.
Have to play.
Yeah, that's a top 10 team at 9-3, right? I mean, if they have a two, if this is a team that has two losses and then you see how it shakes out and there are a couple teams that have one loss, you could see them in that playoff conversation depending on who they lost to, when they lost to.
Absolutely.
That's what's fascinating to me, led by Kellen Mond and what Jimbo's done in year two, entering year two and what he can do. How do you view LSU here? And now this is an idea where they feel like they have finally got the quarterback. And we've been talking about all the talent for decades. It feels like decades with LSU waiting for that quarterback. Do you feel like they are ready to take that next step?
Well, I mean, people want to dissect Joe Burrow and look at his throwing form or, his inconsistencies and how at times his efficiency isn't very good. I throw all, when it comes to Joe Burrow, I throw all of that aside. Because what LSU needs this year, of course, if those things are better, it's great. But Joe Burrow, much like Sam Ehlinger, is a guy that's going to lead his team. It's going to be 3rd and 7 and everybody's covered and they're on the road and he can't hear himself think and he takes off on a scramble and he's about 3 yards short of the first down and instead of giving up on the play and running out of bounds, this dude's going to dive like Superman 4 yards through the air, get hit by two guys, come up bleeding from his chin, and they're going to say first down. And his offensive linemen are going to look at him like he's a superhero.
Yep.
And that's who he is. He's a coach's son. In fact, what an incredible story. His dad's been at Ohio University as a defensive coordinator for years with Frank Solich, steps down this year because I want to watch my son. I'm going to every game he plays. I'll never get this opportunity
again.
Good for him. And so that to me is an incredible story. I'm a Joe Burrow guy. I'm 100% in his corner, and he's got obviously a ton of weapons to be able to throw the football to. But we're going to find out. I think when they go to Austin in a couple weeks, it's not only it's a non-conference game, but if this team is daring to dream for the big opportunity, we're going to beat Bama, we're going to win the SEC, and they really feel that this is their year to do that with Burrow, then they've got to be able to go to Austin and endure that atmosphere and find a way to win a game on a road. And if they do, now you start to really get excited for the kind of year that they can have because the schedule really does set up because they can get on a run. Most of their tough games at home there in Baton Rouge where they're so tough to beat, including games like Florida, including Auburn. And then, of course, they have to go to Tuscaloosa. But if they beat Texas, it is stock up on the LSU Tigers because of the defense that they have, because of the pass rush that they have, the secondary, Joe Burrow, the backs, the receivers. It's just a matter if they can beat if they lose to Texas, it's like, hey, we got to dust ourselves off, regroup, get ready for conference play. It's a different feel. If they beat Texas, you throw their name without any doubt into the discussion about teams that are trying to track towards that playoff.
I'm with you. You got Texas on the road, and then after that, you got Florida at home, like you mentioned, Auburn at home, and then the bye before the trip to Tuscaloosa, and then you close out the season against A&M. Let's now go to the East. And I thought, Florida, granted, it's one game. I thought Florida cut that gap between Florida and Georgia a little bit closer. Let's just talk about Georgia right now. And Georgia's gap to Alabama. Is it as close as 2 and 3 like we're seeing in polls? What's it like in your mind right now?
Well, for me, it is. I mean, they've 2 years ago they had them beat.
Yep.
In a national title. Last year they had them beat in the SEC championship game. So the fact that Jake Fromm is back, and I know he lost almost all of his receivers, but the fact that Jake Fromm is back, even though Tua's back on the other side. I think you have to still look at Georgia as clearly they're the team to beat in the East. Based on what we saw from Florida week one, they have a long way to go in order to be able to get up there with Georgia. Fromm is that calming influence. Fromm is the guy that the play might be called in wrong. He fixes it. A guy might be lined up on the wrong side of the field. He fixes it. A back might not know what's going on. It's almost like it's okay. He's helping everybody out. There's an awareness like a coach. And to me, he has a chance to really put it together and help his young wide receivers. The way I'm banking on the recruiting, the way they've done that over the years, that these young receivers are going to come along and help them. And by the time they get 2 or 3 games under their belt, they're going to be fine in that area. We know about Kirby in the defense. There's every reason to believe when you go down their schedule and start to look who they have to play and where they're playing them, unless they get upset, they just take their eye off the ball, which I can't imagine them doing. It'd be shocking to see them lose a game until they get to the Auburn game, where they've got to play Auburn on the road. But other than that, I think Georgia gets into the SEC championship game. I think they play Alabama again. And to me, it's just a matter of whoever wins that game is heading to the playoff. And depending on really where we are, you might see one of them win and the other one still make it to the playoff. You know, there still could be that possibility as well.
And DeAndre Swift in that backfield, he's the guy that you can guarantee, regardless of the situation, is going to get you 5 to 6 yards every time he touches the football. And you mentioned this too. We've done this countless times. I mean, a total of 64 seconds. Alabama's held the lead in the two wins against Georgia. 64 seconds when you look at eight quarters of play the last time, the last two games for these two powerhouses. All right, so we've wrapped it up. We've taken a look at, you know, the Power Five conferences. Is there one group of five team? Is this UCF in your mind? Or is there somebody else in the group of five that you think it could make a run in the conversation of the top 10?
I think Boise State has a possibility. I don't know if this is going to be one of the years that a team comes in out of the American. I mean, UCF, because of the way they can score. Cincinnati, you know, if you're looking at the American.
They're very good, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and they've got most of their team coming back. You know, Brandon Wimbush, people have forgotten about him. He comes back in the opportunity to start after being at Notre Dame all those years and becomes a quarterback in a prolific offense. So I'm very excited to see how he can do taking over at UCF. I just want to say this about UCF. It seems like for the last 3 or 4 years, UCF has taken their team up to a very, very high level, and their fans have kind of jumped up and down. Why don't we get respect? Why don't we get respect? And they had that kind of that national championship parade and all that at Disney World. And what I remember saying to them was, as much as you feel like you want that respect right away, when you come from off the radar, you have to kind of earn your way there. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to agree with it, but it's just – history shows you. Boise State, they didn't just all of a sudden have a good year and now they're ranked in the top five. Like, they had to have the Jared Zebranski Statue of Liberty play against Ian Johnson. Like, they had to have some moments where they beat teams like Oklahoma. You know, they beat teams on big stages. And after 2 years and 3 years and 4 years, next thing you know, Kellen Moore, his last year was the beneficiary where they were really controlling their own destiny to make it into the BCS until they were upset on a Friday night by Colin Kaepernick in Nevada. Up until that point, the Boise brand over the course of, like I said, beating teams on big stages like Oklahoma, traveling to FedEx Field and beating a very good Virginia Tech team, traveling to Atlanta in the Georgia Dome on a regular season game week one and beating Georgia, top 10 team. Like, when that happened year after year after year, they started to get ranked higher and higher and higher in the preseason. Now you look at UCF, I don't know if I can tell you they're better in 2019 than, let's say, they were last year or the year before that or the year before that. But here they find themselves preseason number 17.
Some respect, right?
Yeah, so that's my point is UCF, you're wondering where's the respect. It comes over time when you show people we're not a one-year trick pony. This is a every year thing. It's a brand that's going to survive and be around. And now without Mackenzie Milton, without some of the playmakers that they've had in the past, they may not be as gifted as they've been, but yet that brand now is respected, and UCF fans should be proud of what the past teams and players have been able to provide for them, because now I don't know if they deserve it, but there they are at number 17. Time will tell if they are deserving, but I would put them and Cincinnati in there. Like I said, I think Boise State is a team that probably deserves always to be looked at just because of the job that Brian Harsin has done and taken over that program. So I would probably put them up there. But those would be the main three, at least, that jump out. Maybe Army has a possibility.
No one wants to face Army. And that's how, I mean, literally coming off a phenomenal season, that turnaround has been amazing. No one wants to face them, especially up front, because the following week you're going to pay for it.
And remember when Army played Oklahoma in a game last year? I mean, that was a close game. And now, you know, they're going to have an opportunity to go in and take on Michigan early in the year this year. So, like you say, I don't think anybody looks at the schedule and says, oh, great, you know, we get our chance against Army. I think it's that thing.
No one's feeling that. And, no. And you mentioned respect, too. UCF can earn a lot, I think, in the voters' minds as well. When you look at September 14th, they got Stanford at home. Then they travel to Pitt. And then a couple weeks later, it's that Friday night showdown at Cincinnati. That game's on ESPN. We're going to learn a lot in that 4 week stretch of UCF and where they are in the conversation as it gets a little bit deeper on Tuesday nights when we have those playoff conversations where the top 25 is and a group of five is in that top 25 ranking. All right, let's talk about the playoff here. Who are your four teams?
I'm going to pick Alabama to come out of the SEC. I'm very, very close to considering Georgia and Alabama, but I'm just going to say, because if Alabama's ranked up at one or two and being dominant with Tua, and they go into that SEC championship game, and let's say Georgia finally gets them, they clip them and beat them by in a close game, you'll find a lot of people that'll say Georgia should be there, and how do you not put Alabama in as well?
So exactly.
That could possibly happen because, remember, it's not fair. They're not a conference champion. It's the best four teams. And if you're ranked one or two all year and you lose by a field goal at the end of the year to be finish the year 12-1 and you lose 27-24, and now we're going to say, no, you're not a conference champion. You're not one of the best four. It's bogus. It won't happen. So if Georgia were to beat Bama in Atlanta, there's a strong possibility in my mind that that happens. But for now, I think Alabama will be in there. I think Clemson out of the ACC will be in there. I think Ohio State, who has somewhat of a chip on their shoulder for people, all this talk, I feel like from what I hear out of Columbus about Michigan and Josh Gattis and the fact that Urban Meyer and Dwayne Haskins are no longer there and who's this Ryan Day guy, I think there's a lot of people, a lot of the players that are anxious to get the season started. And J.K. Dobbins, a name we haven't brought up, look for him to have a Heisman-like year now that Mike Weber is gone and now it's his show. I think he'll put up huge numbers this year, especially the style of offense they'll run. With Justin Fields, more of a runner at this point, and he'll grow into becoming a better passer. So Ohio State will be the third team. And out of the Big 12, I'm going to pick Texas. So those would be my four: Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, and Texas. And I think the championship, people won't like to hear it, but unless I just want to be different to be different, I think it's Tua and Trevor, and would it be the fifth time again those two teams meeting? And I would have Tua and Alabama. A team that I think is pretty angry after the way they played last year. I would give them the edge in preseason, and Alabama would win the championship.
That just shows you the gap that where 1 and 2 is, and then you could throw in Georgia right there as a 2A. That shows you the gap from where we are in the top three to where everybody else is. And yep. I'm with you on Ohio State. I think they're going to be very, very good, and they kind of like how you can doubt them a little bit and question how Ryan Day is going to be because Urban's not there. They got a little chip on their shoulder, but I also feel like that conversation where you can interchange potentially Texas and Oklahoma. If you put in Oklahoma, you have the top five, and that gives you an idea that top five, and then where it drops off from 6 all the way down to 25. You can interchange between potentially 6 to 10 with 11 to 15 at least early in the season. Now everything can change, injuries can change, and players could step up and players could fall apart, and you know. But it just gives you an idea of where we are. We are top heavy. To me, that's an okay thing with college football, especially when you have a playoff. It's okay to be top heavy.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's going to be a lot easier to talk about this when we get 5 or 6 weeks in. But as we sit here right now, I'm with you. I think it's Clemson and Alabama, but I don't think it's Clemson and Alabama, and then, in my opinion, a significant drop, and then we get to teams like Georgia and Oklahoma, Ohio State, and all these other teams. I think, you know, you have to start with Clemson and Alabama because of the way they play, the way they recruit, the way their quarterbacks are coming back. But man, think about these other teams. You got Georgia with Jake Fromm and all that they have. You got Oklahoma, which is an exciting team to think about with Jalen Hurts. think of the job Lincoln Riley's done, 2 years, two Heismans, and now here comes Jalen Hurts. So they're out there. Ohio State, we just talked about with Ryan Day and Justin Fields, J.K. Dobbins, an incredibly athletic defense that was embarrassed a year ago, that they're going to be playing angry with new defensive coordinators. LSU, we just talked about Joe Burrow, the schedule that they have. Can they get by Texas early? Michigan's out there with Shea Patterson. Josh Gattis and this offense, it's going to be exciting to watch. Don Brown in the defense. Notre Dame's out there. We haven't really talked,
talked about them. And Ian Book,
Ian Book, and he's got some young playmakers he's working with. Texas, you got Oregon, you got, so I mean, there's, it's not just, well, who cares? It's two teams. To me, you got two teams, but you also have another 9 to 12 that if they can catch fire and stay healthy, and you just never know where they could be by the time you get to the middle of October. And at that point, it becomes a free-for-all.
Great conversation here. Let's wrap things up, and let's talk a little bit about the Heisman. Do you have a top three right now early on? It's so hard for us to do this, considering that no one had Kyler Murray anywhere on the radar a year ago at this time.
Yeah, to me, you're right. You almost have to eliminate Tua and Trevor from the discussion, because again, unless you're just trying to be different, if you're trying to be right, then, and you know, you and I are having a friendly wager, chances are we're going to probably say it's almost like Tiger when Tiger was in his prime.
Exactly.
Tiger versus the field.
Versus the field. Exactly.
Yeah. So let's eliminate those two. After that, I'm picking the Sam Ellinger, because I think Texas has a chance, and I think Sam has an opportunity to kind of grab the attention of the journalists and the others that vote, but because of his style of play. And if Texas is winning, I think he has a chance to kind of become kind of an American heartthrob. If they beat LSU and he's out there being rah-rah guy and running over safeties and getting up being tough, and they're 3-0 and they're 4-0, pretty good chance that Sam Ellinger's on the cover of SI and on the cover of a lot of places, becoming one of the faces of the sport. So that would be my guy outside of the two quarterbacks. But I think you can make a really good case for Jake Fromm, even though he's got obviously an incredible and very, very talented running back and Swift behind him. How do you not include Jalen Hurts with what Lincoln Riley's done with quarterbacks and Baker and Kyler Murray? So, you know, and then there's going to be two or three names. I would say Justin Herbert, but I don't know if anybody out West gets enough recognition or attention. You know, if Andrew Luck can't win the Heisman, I don't know if anybody out West is going to, unless you go to USC, is going to win the Heisman.
And Herbert, one thing he can do this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
He could set the narrative, right? You beat an SEC team and you're nowhere near home. You do it on the biggest stage that is ABC on Saturday night in prime time.
Amen.
All
you're right.
Right
about that.
Looking forward to it.
A lot of fun. Have a great week, and we're ready to go. We got week zero behind us, and now we got a full slate of games. Going to be a fun week.
Cannot wait for Thursday night and where we get started, and then you guys with game day on Saturday. We want to remind everybody, college football is celebrating its 150th anniversary, and we have a podcast that takes you back to some of the most iconic moments in the sport, such as Jimmy Johnson transforming college football with his style, the fall of USC, how Michael Vick electrified on the field, and many other stories. And you can check it out on the Down and Distance podcast hosted by Ivan Maisel, who will join us on Wednesday. Talk to you then.